Hello, Con.
Hi, Bill. How are you doing this week?
I'm doing all right. How are you?
I'm great. Very excited for this week's This Week in Vlog.
It's been an exciting... every political week's been exciting lately, even in the doldrums of summer.
Yeah, I think it's, as I said before, it's been more entertaining since we are no longer talking about Obama-Clinton. We reached a new era of exciting.
Can Obama-McCain be exciting all the way through November, though? Will this storyline get dull at some point?
Well, you know what? We don't have a choice. We're going to have to find out.
We can start talking about Bob Barr and Ralph Nader. Cynthia McKinney gets no attention.
And that's a shame. But we're not here to talk about Cynthia McKinney today.
So what's top of your mind this week?
Well, I thought number one would be the divergent blog reactions on Nuri al-Maliki's call for a timetable withdrawal of U.S. troops as part of a status of force agreement that will or will not get signed with the United States before George Bush leaves office.
Well, it's definitely something that a number of liberal bloggers called attention to. Folks dug up McCain's comments from 2004, saying if the Iraqi government told us to leave, then I guess we'd have to leave. And noting that McCain was not singing the same tune presently, the folks at Democracy Arsenal had analyzed what McCain and other conservatives were saying. They seemed to be, you hear the phrase political statement a lot. Maliki's making a political statement, the subtext being that he doesn't really mean it, that it's not what's going to be part of the final negotiated agreement between him and the Bush administration. He's only saying that sort of thing for domestic consumption, and the folks at Democracy Arsenal were criticizing that, saying you were making Maliki look weaker in the eyes of his own people by making that case. Are conservative bloggers concerned about that at all, that they are going to be weakening Maliki's standing in this process?
No, not really. I mean, really they've been focusing mostly on just pointing out the difference between having the Iraqis call for a timetable withdrawal now and having the Democrats call for a timetable withdrawal much earlier. Rick Moran at Right Wing Nuthouse, great name for a blog, says... The Iraqis want our combat forces to leave in an orderly fashion by withdrawing troops using a timetable that will be mutually agreed upon. What's not to like in this? Well, if you're President Bush or John McCain, you have a political problem in that you've been opposing a timetable being attached to withdrawal for years. But that was the Democrats setting arbitrary timetables, not the sovereign nation of Iraq, giving their problematic allies a graceful way to exit with the honor and true mission accomplished. Saddam is gone, his WMD programs are history. The Iraqi army has proven in Basra, in Sadr City, and most especially in Mosul, that they are capable of handling the security of the country. The police, while still facing large problems of corruption, performed quite well in Mosul also. So what is it we are still needed for? And this was largely echoed throughout the conservative blogosphere, is if the Iraqis are setting a timetable now that victory has been attained, then that's great.
So everyone's for a timetable now, is that it then?
Yeah, you know, I was reading Mick Q at Q&O was highlighting some of the more detailed statements of the Iraqi spokesman, I'm going to butcher this name, Ali al-Dabaga, who was kind of more elaborating on what the timetable would mean. And he said any timetable would, quote, depend on conditions and the circumstances that the country would be undergoing, unquote. But he said pull out within three or four years was possible. And that the pullout could be done by 2011. So what we're seeing is that McCain, in his speech that was totally stepped on by President Bush when he gave that speech attacking or not attacking Barack Obama in the Israeli Knesset, on that same day, McCain gave a speech that was kind of weird in the way he gave it. It was kind of like it's 2012 and McCain's running for election and this is what I've accomplished in the past 4 years. And one of them was saying that, you know, he brought it into the Iraq War, won the Iraq War, and we're bringing troops home. So you have McCain who says he wants to, you know, in his ideal world, he wants to bring the troops home by 2012. You have the Iraqi government saying that the pullout could be done by 2011. And then you have Barack Obama saying it should be done in 16 months, which by my math means 2010. So it seems that everyone wants to bring the troops home, some by 2010, some by 2011, and McCain by 2012.
Well, except McCain has also expressed comfort with folks in the military being in Iraq for 50, 100 years. There's still a permanent military presence that is a key plank of his foreign policy vision. So
there's nothing that Barack Obama has said that's contradicted that.
Except that he has said he's against permanent military bases repeatedly.
Well, it depends what you mean by residual forces now, doesn't it?
Well, Obama says for temporary residual forces.
Well, you know, these guys are only going to be president for at most 8 years.
All true, but I still think there is a distinct difference when you're communicating what your long-term foreign policy objectives are and your ability to be able to execute them well and maintain stability in that region in the process. If you have clearly and repeatedly signaled that you have long-term designs, and you have something that's a little off in the distance for your alleged withdrawal timetable, and you have a backdoor thing saying, well, we're going to withdraw by 2012, but we're still going to have 40,000 troops at the end of that. That's not going to be accepted as credibly on the ground in Iraq and in the region. And I don't even get that sense from McCain that he's even being all that firm about having all combat troops out by that date.
Right, but as we discussed, I believe the last time we talked, I got you to commit to the idea that as long as the Iraqi people were fine with permanent bases in Iraq, you would be too.
But they're not.
Well, you know, the LA Times, in their write-up of Nouri al-Maliki's statement, said, the suggestion made during an official visit to the United Arab Emirates appeared aimed at easing domestic fears that the status of force deal would impinge on Iraqi sovereignty, and it would clear the way for permanent American bases. So
they're trying to make the argument that that's not going to mean that, because they know the Iraqi people do not want that.
No, I think what they're trying to say is that they're trying to put the timetable in there for Maliki to allow there to be some permanent bases.
So say that again. Say the report again.
Oh, the Los Angeles Times quote. The suggestion made during an official visit to the United Arab Emirates appeared aimed at easing domestic fears that the deal would impinge on Iraqi sovereignty and clear the way for permanent American bases. So it's up in the air whether or not the Iraqi people are still going to want these American bases. And, you know, we'll see when that time comes in 2012, whoever's president, whether or not they're going to want to end that presence. But at the
I certainly didn't take the reading of what you read as evidence that the Iraqi people want American military bases there permanently. It seemed like sort of an awkwardly worded sentence, but I sort of like to see more concrete evidence of that from the mouths of the Iraqi people themselves that they really want such a thing. I don't think the evidence is there for that. And actually, I think Maliki's statements about having a timetable would say the opposite.
Well, we'll have to see. We'll have to see whether or not how lengthy the timetable and the permanent presence is.
So is it safe to say then, because you're now the conservative blogosphere is warmly embracing a timetable, that they do not want a permanent military presence in Iraq either?
What they want is for the Iraqi sovereign people to, you know, work with the American government on something, on a security agreement that they can both agree with. They see that that Saddam's been removed, the weapons of mass destruction program is gone, there's a progress in the democratic level of the government in Iraq, and those are all huge accomplishments that they'd be happy pocketing.
Well, the last time, you know, the Iraqi parliament had said, I believe it was a year ago, that they didn't want American forces to stay permanently. And John McCain had said, well, you know, that's not what the prime minister says. No, that's politics. That's always been the line whenever these stuff has come up, that it's just politics and it's not what really is going to happen. And essentially saying that whatever is a negotiated agreement between the Bush administration and the current Iraqi government, which is propped up by an American military presence, so it's hard to say they're acting from free will. That in and of itself is not necessarily representative of what the Iraqi people want. So if you come back at me a couple weeks later and saying, hey, look what Bush and Maliki hammered out, and it's going to leave this wiggle room for a permanent presence, a definite presence down the line, that's not evidence to me that the Iraqi people actually want it, and it'll be interesting to see what the Iraqi people's reaction is going to be to that. They're obviously trying very hard, both the Bush administration and the Maliki government, to use a lot of convoluted phrasing, lots of intergovernmental gobbledygook to try to obfuscate what the actual agreement is going to mean over the long term.
Well, I think convoluted phrasing is a good transition to our next topic, which is whether or not Barack Obama has already or will flip-flop on Iraq. And Josh Marshall and Matthew Glazes were particularly incensed about this. Josh writes, I must confess to being a little short of astounded by the avalanche of press BS I'm reading on Barack Obama's position on Iraq. I watched this campaign unfold pretty closely, and I've listened to Obama's positions on Iraq. He's been very clear through this year and last on the distinction between strategy and tactics. President set the strategy, which in this context means the goal or priority. And if the policy is a military one, a president will consult closely with his military advisors on the tactics used to execute the policy. He goes on, the simple truth is that this campaign offers a very clear-cut choice on Iraq. One candidate believes that the U.S. occupation of Iraq is the solution, and the other thinks it's the problem. John McCain supports the permanent deployment of U.S. troops in Iraq. That is why his 100 years mark isn't some gotcha line. It's a clear statement of policy. Obama supports a deliberate and orderly withdrawal of U.S. forces from Iraq. It's a completely different view of Americans' role in the world and future in the Middle East. Reporters who can't grasp what Obama is saying seem simply to have been permanently befuddled by George W. Bush's game plan over delegating policy to commanders. So I'm guessing you've been frustrated by the line. And Josh here was attacking the Associated Press, but it's not just the Associated Press. If you look at pretty much any paper from the New York Times, the Washington Post, they've all pretty much adopted the line that Obama has shifted on Iraq. I'm guessing you are you in the Josh Marshall, Matthew Glazes camp that says, he's not?
I have my own post up on this as well, Obama consistent on Iraq. You know, back in September of 2007, there was a moment in MSNBC debate. A few days prior, Senator Clinton refused to take a pledge that all troops would be out by 2013. And I had blogged at the time, here's the opportunity for Edwards and Obama to make a big distinction on their Iraq policies, that they would take that pledge and Clinton would not. They had the opportunity to do that in the following debate. The question was put to them point blank. And both Edwards and Obama refused to take the pledge as well. And Obama specifically said, that's my goal, but I can't foresee all the things that might happen over the course of the next 4 years, and I don't want to make a promise that I can't keep. More recently, in the heat of the primaries in February on 60 Minutes, he was asked by Steve Croft if he would hold to his timetable regardless of what happened on the ground, and Obama said no. I always have the right as commander-in-chief to reassess. So he's always had this flexibility as part of his proposal. It is a pretty basic flexibility you'd expect for any commander-in-chief. I think there are probably some folks on the left that it probably makes them nervous that maybe he wouldn't follow through on withdrawal. You can be right to be skeptical about what that flexibility means. But as far as it being a shift, a change in view after the primary is over to appeal to a different electorate in the general, that's just factually untrue.
Well, I think, when the Josh Marshalls and Matthew Glazes of the world bring up this point, they're trying to work the rest, the press coverage, to get headlines to go more the direction. And two of the bloggers that are part of that animal they're trying to influence, Jonathan Martin and Mark Amater, had some posts on this issue. Jonathan Martin wrote under a post titled, "The True Test of Obama's Shift on Iraq," and he quotes a Military Times interview, which Martin calls some of the most unambiguous language Obama has employed yet to indicate he's retreating from his democratic primary position on Iraq. And then he quotes from the Military Times. This is from Obama. If current trends continue and we're in a position where we continue to see reductions in violence and stabilizations and continue to see some improvements on the part of the Iraqi army and Iraqi police, then you know my hope would be that we could draw down in deliberate fashion in consultation with the Iraqi government at a pace that is determined in consultation with General Petraeus and other commanders on the ground. And then Martin contrasts that with Obama's website directly below that, which reads, Obama will immediately begin to remove our troops from Iraq. He will remove one or two combat brigades each month and have all our combat brigades out of Iraq within 16 months. Obama will make it clear that we will not build any permanent bases in Iraq. He'll keep some troops in Iraq to protect our embassy and diplomats.
Where Martin's making the mistake, and it's worth noting that the nuance that Obama has given during the campaign trail on a number of occasions is not evident in the paragraph that's on the website. The website essentially, this is my plan. The nuance is, you know, if conditions change or other things come up, I reserve the right to reassess that plan.
So at least we're seeing there's definitely been a shift in nuance, a shift in emphasis in Obama's part on Iraq.
If you think it's a shift that started in September 2007, but you can't say that this is a brand new shift because the primaries are over and he doesn't care about primary voters anymore, which is what the media narrative has been. That is what's factually untrue. As far as what do you think this means, how sincere do you believe he is, if this is honest nuance or illegitimate, you know, backdoor wiggle room, that is a matter of opinion and a matter of what level do you take Obama at his word. But the notion that he is changing his position because the primaries are done, the general election has begun, that is a factually untrue thing to say in regards to the Iraq position. I would argue on most of these things that are being talked about.
Well, I would say that he's always left the door open, but I think what the rest of the media is picking up on is that he's definitely changed his emphasis. Let me go ahead and read this Mark Ambiter post. On the one hand, this is indeed the position that Obama had months ago, the position expressed by Obama when in a contemplative mode or by advisors when they are extending his policy. On the other hand, it is also true that many times Obama and his advisors used his troop withdrawal promise, see David Plouffe's crystal clarity, without nuance and deliberately in the shorthand that implies that the opinion of the generals in regards to Obama's strategy won't matter that much at all. And I think that's really the question that is very completely open. Is that nobody really knows how much deference Obama is going to give to Petraeus at all. You either believe that Obama is going to kind of forcefully tell David Petraeus that, no, I mean it, I want these brigades brought home to a month, or he's going to be kind of more open to having David Petraeus say, no, Obama, you're inexperienced, we need to bring troops closer to my idea of what needs to be done. And we'll eventually see whether or not Obama has the political courage to stick to his 16-month promise.
Let me just say this: he's going to go to Iraq this month. He's going to be with military commanders this month. I imagine whatever he says after those series of meetings is going to be heavily publicized.
You think so?
I think so.
I'm going to go ahead and bet with you on that one.
And maybe it's best to revisit this conversation after that happens.
Okay.
Next, sir?
Yes, next. Whether or not Obama has flip-flopped on Iraq, certain elements of the GOP, some bloggers, are definitely trying to push that as a line of attack on Obama, and definitely the McCain camp is. And there was a series of discussions in the blogosphere about whether or not that flip-flop charge would work against Barack Obama. And Chris Bowers had a post on this. I have grave doubts that a flip-flop charge is actually effective in a political campaign, especially in an Obama versus McCain campaign. Consider the following. Number one, if Obama is Kerry, then McCain is Bush. Bush argued that John Kerry is a flip-flopper, and everyone remembers that charge quite well. As such, for the McCain campaign to argue that Obama is a flip-flopper should actually cause voters to compare McCain to Bush just as much as they might compare Obama to Kerry. Right now, being tied to Bush is a lot worse than being tied to Kerry. Two, doesn't contradict Obama's image. Obama, unlike Kerry, has been running on his willingness to engage in bipartisan compromise for over a year. so it isn't clear how the flip-flop charge even goes against Obama's long-standing campaign promises. He has told everyone repeatedly that he will compromise, so it's unclear how attacking him for doing this will hurt him. Three, do people even dislike flip-floppers? A January 27,000 poll from Pew showed that 75% of voters like candidates who are willing to compromise. That was slightly higher than the 67% of voters who like politicians who stick to their principles. And four, has anyone flip-flopped more than McCain? There are few politicians in the last 20 years who have flip-flopped more than McCain.
I'd add to that, by the way, you know, Steve Bennett at the Carpetbagger Report has been chronicling McCain flip-flops for a while now. He's now up to 61. So I'll put that link up to on the side of this here.
Yeah, and the I think that, you know, the GOP bloggers are in a – the conservative bloggers are in a kind of a fix because if anything, we want John McCain to flip-flop more. You know, he's already flip-flopped for more Julian on the Outer Continental Shelf, which we thought was great, but we still want him to flip-flop on Anwar. So it's hard for us to defend John McCain as non-flip-flopper.
Always greedy conservatives, always greedy.
Yes, we're very greedy. We want as much as McCain will give us, and considering many of his we'll call them bipartisan positions in the past, we're hoping he flip-flops more. But what I thought was interesting was agreeing with Chris Bowers, which happens all the time, was Rush Limbaugh. We know how much Chris Bowers and Rush Limbaugh get along. But Rush Limbaugh, who's the transcripts from Limbaugh's radio show are put up at a site, and often National View Online will link to them, not on a regular basis, but when they have items that the editors consider important. And so Rush had a bit this past week on how the Obama flip-flop charge will not work. This is quoting from El Rushbo. On this flip-flop business, let's not use the word flip-flop. I don't think it's going to persuade anybody. It worked with Kerry because Kerry was such an idiot. I mean, his flip-flops were funny. I voted before I voted against it. You got to remember one thing about these flip-flops, and I'm going to stop using the term here just in a second. Most people are not really paying close attention to this right now. Despite what might be called record levels of tension, those of us who are involved in this on a day-to-day basis, we are absorbed and we are detail-orientated. We know Obama upwards and forwards and backwards and hindwards and all that. But the time most people start turning in, his centrist positions, his so-called flip-flops, are actually going to be the things about him that they know. So we have to portray this guy as inexperienced, far leftist, despite what he's saying about moving to the center. So this just goes back to the discussion Ari and I were having last week about whether or not all the headlines that were coming out of the FISA debate, which was finally voted on yesterday, and Obama voted for the FISA bill. Ari was making the case that it hurt Obama, and I had the exact opposite, that all the headlines I was reading from the papers, not just reading the articles, but just going and reading each of the headlines from across the nation were, you know, Obama, centrist Obama, moving the center on FISA, bipartisan compromise, and I thought that helped Obama. What's your opinion?
Well, we've had USA Today Gallup. I'm not a big fan of the Gallup tracking poll, by the way. But USA Today Gallup, which is separate from the Gallup tracking poll, they had a poll out in June and a poll that came out today. In June, Obama was up 50-44. Today, Obama was up 48-42. So it's a six-point lead in both cases, but both Obama and McCain lost a little bit. And I suspect you essentially have neither campaign has been able to control their own narrative at all. They're both getting kind of nitpicked by mainstream media. They're getting nitpicked by folks in their bases. And so bad narratives have been conjured up in both. They don't have a massive effect on where they stand in the broader electorate, but they've been sort of knocked down by a very small peg in the process. So that's my sense of how all this stuff has actually mattered from a political standpoint. But I guess there's two things I would add to that as far as where the liberal blogosphere stands. Bowers agreed with Rush in what respect?
Oh, and the fact that the flip-flop charge was not going to be effective against Obama.
I wouldn't necessarily be so sanguine about that because it obviously, at minimum, it gets in his way. Even if it doesn't, you know, make support erode for him, it certainly is an obstacle to get over in trying to communicate broader themes and try to build a larger mandate for action, presuming he does win. You know, everything little thing is being put under the microscope in a way that I would argue has been unfair and inaccurate because it's not taking into account things he said in the past. And this is a theme of mine in our dialogues for a long time, because a lot of well-read liberal bloggers are not fully on the Obama bandwagon, and the Laissez FISA thing, you know, put a farther wedge between them. You see a lot of liberal bloggers very eager to beat up McCain. You do not see them very eager to defend Obama when arguably false narratives are being put upon him. They're not rushing to be his wingmen when that happens. So Obama's still out there, and in some cases I think some liberal bloggers have been feeding some of these narratives, expressing concern that Obama is moving rightward and not being true to progressive principles. So that makes it harder for Obama to push back on some of these things. You know, I don't necessarily think it's going to make him lose. It might make it harder to win big, and put a very, you know, insurmountable lead between him and McCain during this downtime in the summer.
Well, I think something you said a little earlier in that bit was something I strongly agree with, is that it may not necessarily hurt him to win, but it will hurt his mandate to enact a progressive agenda, and that the more he muddles it, the less of mandate he has to move far to the left.
Well, this is the question I think for liberal progressive bloggers to ask themselves. In my analysis, and I've written about this at the Campaign for America's Future blog, the distance between your average liberal voter and your average moderate voter is much, much smaller right now than it is between your moderate voter and your conservative voter. It should be relatively easy to establish a mandate on some of the big things as far as role of government, public investment, healthcare for all, fighting global warming, change in foreign policy, having aggressive diplomacy with Iran, and not having a permanent occupation in Iraq. You can build that coalition between liberal and moderate voters right now. So do you emphasize the areas where Obama is not especially liberal and feed a media narrative that Obama has to do such things because the country is still center-right and it's not center-left? Or do you play up the areas where Obama is sticking to reaffirming liberal principles, which has been true in a number of areas in recent days, public investment, health care, environment, opposing coastal drilling in favor of investment in renewable energy, aggressive diplomacy with Iran, equal pay for women. There's been a score of these issues. I even talked about how McCain doesn't believe in a role of government to stop unscrupulous lending practices. You haven't seen...
Well, a role for the federal government.
I'm sorry?
Well, a role for the federal government.
Right. Obama saying he's for it and emphasizing that McCain does not believe that. There's been no elevation when Obama says things like that in the liberal blogosphere, things that could help strengthen that mandate for action going forward. Instead, you've had the emphasis on the areas where he breaks from the views of where liberal bloggers are. And you can go either way with that. In one respect, you don't want to be Obama's lapdog. You want to be in a position to be independent from his campaign and to push when necessary, and to make sure that he is, you know, it's held accountable. I thought that what Mike Stark did, which was praised by Bowers at Open Left recently, Mike Stark's the one who started the group on Obama's website that he should change his position on FISA and vote against the bill, and that became a very well-growing group. Obama felt the need to talk to that group and put up a statement on his website and Huffington Post to respond to their concerns. Even though Obama didn't change his vote, I thought it was a healthy dynamic that those folks got heard, and Obama felt compelled to respond to them. I think it's probably a big step forward in open source politics, It's a warning shot, if you will. I think it lets Obama know that he can't just do whatever and expect folks to always be there with him. So that dialogue remains. So the bloggers might want to think about balancing to what extent do you play up the areas of disagreement and push, and to what extent you play up the areas of agreement that aren't getting the full attention from the mainstream media.
Fair enough. We're going to move away from Obama for a minute and talk about one specific issue, energy. T. Boone Pickens, who's an oil man out of Texas, has launched a national, I don't know if it's national, but definitely it's on my television.
Oh, I've seen the ads here on plenty of stations. So, I think he's putting the money on the table.
So we're guessing a national television buy, quite a wide blogger. Blitz, I saw it all over the place. Instapundit, The Corner, Think Progress, you name it. Most blogs had a comment on it. And basically, he has a energy plan, which he wants leadership on, I guess is what he's calling for. He has an online video. We'll provide the link for that. But the short of it is that. He's not concerned about global warming. He's concerned about the $700 billion America is spending every year, sending overseas every year to buy foreign oil. And his plan is to reduce that number by taking all of our natural gas and using that to power cars, and then the energy that is not used for natural gas to power our homes and businesses would then come from wind, which he is building on a massive scale on his land throughout Texas, and he wants to build it all the way up through Canada. And he has some maps showing that the wind there is great and perfect for wind power. So that's the very short version of his plan.
Well, this has gotten great attention in the Enviro blog community. You had Carl Pope, who is the head of Sierra Club, blogging at Huffington Post, praising Pickens for this. You had other folks, Joseph Rahm, who blogs at Climate Progress and at Grist, called the plan half brilliant, half dumb.
And Joseph Rahm pretty much is Climate Progress.
Yes, I think other folks pop up there from time to time. But that is basically his blog home. And he actually started that post with an interesting anecdote when an unnamed major cable station called him, asked him if he would come on to the station to praise Pickens, and he said, "Well, actually, I think it's half brilliant, half dumb." And the cable person said, "Okay, forget it."
Yeah, that happens every day at the Heritage here, where I'm in the media services department, and so the people around me all day are either calling up cable producers or taking calls from cable producers. And that's pretty standard for cable producers too. They have a very fixed idea of what they want their guests to say. And since there are tons of people in D.C. who want to get on cable television, they pretty much shop around until they find someone who is going to say what they want them to say.
Well, I guess the question is, I don't know what transpired at the end of this. Did they have a segment that at least had the viewpoint of Rahm represented in any way, so you actually heard the full range of viewpoints about it? Or did they have it a overly narrow manufactured determination of what the accepted parameters of debate are?
I don't know. Just Rahm didn't name names, so we'll never know.
We'll never know. But I would argue that happens a fair amount.
Oh, yeah. I can guarantee you it does.
So he and other folks, I know Energy Smart also had a similar criticism that the natural gas part of the Pickens plan doesn't add up. But I think there is a consensus amongst the environmental bloggers that it is extremely notable that a famed oil man, financial backer of the Swift boaters no less, is embracing the peak oil argument that we are running out of oil, that we can't drill our way out of this problem, and we need to be investing in other energy alternatives if we're ever going to have an energy policy where people can afford the energy they need to power their lives.
Yeah, there's ongoing, off-going fire alarms here, so I'm trying to fight through that. But
I guess my question to you is, there was such conservative euphoria over the the Newt Gingrich drill now proposal. I talked about that with Bill Buettler earlier. Was there any acceptance of T. Boone here and saying, and at least acknowledging there's more than one thing that needs to be done to solve this energy problem? Or is it all drilling all the time as far as conservative bloggers are concerned?
Well, I have a number of responses. First, I wanted to highlight a link that actually you sent me from Dana Blankenhorn, which I really liked, and I thought was something you could read on pretty much any conservative blog. First of all, he quoted from Pickens' op-ed in the Wall Street Journal. So this would be Pickens. The government must mandate the formation of wind and solar transmission corridors and renew the subsidies for economic alternative energy development in areas where the wind and sun are abundant. I am also calling for monthly progress report on the reduction in foreign oil imports, as well as monthly progress report on the state of development of natural gas vehicles in the country. And then Dana responds, in other words, subsidize what I'm already doing, overriding the objections to my plan for big windmills and ginormous transition lines hundreds of miles long, give me control and guarantees, make me wind czar, and put all your eggs in my basket. This is why communism fell, because they bought 5 and 10 years plans from goobers like Boone Pickens. He has claimed all his life to be an anti-communist, but his plan reveals him for what he is. He's not a businessman. He's another lobbyist with his hand out. For Siberia, read West Texas.
No, I think it's an excellent point. And it's, T. Boone is not offering a comprehensive energy plan. He is offering an energy plan in two areas, wind and natural gas, where he stands to make a buck off of it. That is a totally fair point. Now, I would add to that, though, and I'm extremely supportive of tax credits and public investment in renewable energy, and there's wind and solar tax credits that are going to expire. That would be very detrimental if they did expire. But our energy policy right now subsidizes nearly everything but renewable energy. We give tax breaks to oil. We subsidize coal. We subsidize nuclear. It's renewable energy that's been left out of the mix here, and that's why it's been straggling as part of our energy mix.
Yeah, I would just disagree with you factually there. Alternative energy has been subsidized for since the 1970s.
Not nearly the scale as we have with other energy sources.
As far as like direct investment, definitely as much. Now, I mean, when you talk about when you qualify, tax credits tax breaks as subsidies, you're skewing it in favor of oil because, of course, oil costs so much money. When you give tax breaks to it, it skews the other way. But as far as direct payments and other matching subsidies programs, alternative energy has been subsidized for, coming on 40 years now.
And that's why there's so much of it, because it's been such a robust
No, there's so much of it because the technology just isn't there yet.
The technology is there. There's plenty of technology that could be made widely affordable and accessible if there was a real public investment program and unleashed a lot more of the venture capital. That's why all these companies are begging for this tax credit to be long-term. Otherwise, there's not enough market certainty to get that venture cap unleashed.
Yeah. You're just not making any sense here because it can't be both economic and affordable that can be adopted on a widespread basis and still need subsidies. Those are two contradictory statements.
Well, it's a kickstart. It's something that gets the market going.
We've been kicking it for 30 years now, almost 40.
No, we haven't.
But anyways, on to other bloggers' reactions. John Hinckley, who was on with you, right?
Yeah.
A couple weeks ago. He had a response at the next right. This is what Hinckley wrote. When a billionaire puts a lot of his own money behind a project, it's a good idea to pay attention. If this is such a good idea, why isn't profit and success sufficient to drive us in that direction? Joseph Rahm raises some interesting questions about what wind power should replace, as well as the efficiency of natural gas and transportation. Sending money to tyrannies is a security problem, but we don't need a rerun of the old Buy America protectionism. I believe more domestic oil production is a marginally useful thing, but a long-term solution probably requires diversified energy sources. I believe the lack of fueling infrastructure is a significant barrier to using natural gas for transportation. I believe the scientific evidence that anthropogenic climate change is occurring is solid. I believe the cost of oil is significantly higher than the price of oil, and the negative externalities of our oil-driven economy are a problem that needs to be solved. I believe regulatory solutions to environmental problems are likely to result in path dependencies and inefficiencies that do more to shift costs around than to actually address them. An effective solution must be market-based so that it works with incentives rather than against them. To Pickens' credit, that seems to be the direction in which he is pressing, with his own money. So there's a bunch in there I agree with and disagree with. I think John is probably more on the in a minority in accepting. Well, not in the minority, except in the, that climate change is real.
John
but
swore up and down to me that he wasn't even a conservative.
That's true. He does, what does he call himself, a neo-libertarian?
I don't even bothered with a label to me. So he just wouldn't accept any label that I put on him.
Well, when he's working with Soren Dayton and Patrick Ruffini over the next right, and the goal of the next right is kind of to mirror open left and become and basically, you know, to help elect more conservatives. So whatever he calls himself, he's trying to elect more conservatives. So I'm going to go ahead and stick that label to him.
You guys can hash that out.
I don't think we haven't. what I did like about John's analysis was that he thought Boone Pickens' plan was moving that direction of market incentives. I much more agree with the lefty blogger that you sent me earlier that what Boone's is calling for, mandates, subsidies, guarantees for the transmission lines, etc., is didn't sound very market-based.
Well, there's a strain of environmental libertarianism. David Roberts on Grist has often said, let's stop subsidizing everything. Let's see oil and gas and coal actually compete without any help with renewable energy and see how they do.
Yeah, that's actually the Heritage position. We're against all subsidies.
I haven't seen you campaigning to strip out these oil tax breaks.
That's true. We haven't been campaigning. We're too busy trying to stop a massive regressive energy tax.
Mm.
It's called priorities. But yeah, no, we fight against all energy subsidies.
You want to give away all this public land to the oil companies for free, I assume, so they could exploit it at will.
Well, it depends on what you mean by give away. The government leases are not free. They pay a substantial amount to for the right to develop those resources.
And
so I don't know what you mean by give
apparently
away.
And apparently, do not use them.
Well, exploration, when you buy a lease, you don't automatically know once you buy it how much oil is there. You then have to invest even more money to find out how much oil is there. And then once you have that information, you have to decide whether or not it's cost effective, if there's anything there, to go ahead and develop it.
Sounds like Coastal Drilling wouldn't lower prices very soon because the supply wouldn't come into play for such a long time.
Well, did I talk about this with you earlier?
Sure,
Marty Feldstein had a great Wall Street Journal op-ed talking about how signaling to the rest of the world that we were willing to develop our own resources could work in a way to lower the price of oil because it signals that more supply is going to be coming on.
Now Marty knows how much oil is actually estimated exists off our shores.
No. You don't have to know that. You just have to know that there is some and there's a lot, and showing that we are willing to develop it will send a signal to the people that are buying in the future markets.
Well, correct me if I'm wrong, but I would think the laws of supply and demand, it would matter how much supply is actually there. And since everyone in the oil business knows how little supply we actually have, it is extremely unlikely that speculators would dramatically drop the price of oil on the commodities market if we agreed to exploit one extra drop off our shores.
Well, it's not one extra drop. Anwar alone would be,
Anwar alone is 10 million barrels of oil, which the Energy Department says would lower the price of crude 75 cents
I love the fact
by
that,
2025.
Yeah, first of all, those estimates were made, 5 years ago when the price of oil was significantly less than it is now. And secondly, I love the fact that the Energy Department thinks they know how they can set prices.
75 cents off a barrel of crude by 2025 was an Energy Department analysis done this spring. And it is an update from what they did 2 years ago. They revised it upwards from 50 cents off a barrel of crude to 75 cents this year.
So let's just say I don't have a lot of faith in the Energy Department predicting oil prices.
They're just the Energy Department.
Yes, they're a government agency. I don't have much faith in the government agency predicting prices. But also interesting on the oil front was a couple articles, one in the Politico and another one in the New York Times on the willingness of Democratic senators, including Harry Reid, Dick Durbin and Jim Webb saying that they were open. They're becoming more and more open to more domestic oil drilling.
We'll see how open they are. I think there's been a spate of poll numbers that have come out that show favorability towards coastal drilling.
Yes, across the board, Pew, Gallup, Rasmussen have all showed. The Pew poll was the most striking in the cross tabs that showed how much support for drilling was growing among Democrats, among independents, among females, among self-described liberals. The support for drilling is growing across the board, which led to this great blog post by James Tarantino, also at the Wall Street Journal. He writes, blogger Tigerhawk notes that the results of a new Pew survey, which shows a dramatic increase in the percentage of Americans who say expanding exploration and production is more important than conservation, from 35% in February, when gas is around $3 a gallon, to 47% in June. Support has risen especially among Obama constituencies, college graduates up 17 points, Democrats up 16 points, independents up 19 points, liberals up 23 points, 18 to 29-year-olds up 25 points. Normally, you'd expect high gas prices to help the party out of power, but Obama's opposition to increased energy production is a weakness McCain could easily exploit. Durbin's comments may be a signal that Obama will pivot soon.
Well, of course, this is the fun concern. Everything is going to be a case where Obama's going to flip-flop, because everyone knows he flip-flops on everything.
I know. It's a great parlor game. what will be next?
Well, let me say a couple things. Number one, you know, when the gas tax holiday debate happened, and Obama really planted his flag firmly and was running ads about how the gas tax holiday wouldn't actually save anybody any money, he was able to actually turn the media coverage around. All these economists came out agreeing with him, saying that this wasn't going to save any money, and he turned the poll numbers around. You know, I think it was pretty obvious that McCain and Clinton took the gas tax holiday stance because there was poll data saying it would be popular. But when
was there?
I'm making an assumption that there was private polling saying that. I can't otherwise imagine why they would take that position. And clearly, after the debate was had and the information came out, the poll numbers showed that people support Obama's position, particularly independents. Now, I don't think that debate has really been had in full here. There hasn't been the same amount of push for the argument that coastal drilling would not actually save you any money. A number of the polls that you cited preface by saying, in order to reduce gas prices, would you support coastal drilling? If the presumption is going to lower prices, people will say, sure, why not? If it was put out in the poll number, well, it would only save you 6 cents a gallon 20 years from now, you might get a very different poll number. Now, the question is, seeing the articles you said about what Democrats might do, you still aren't seeing Democrats talking about embracing the Bush-McCain proposal in full. You're talking about maybe a compromise proposal where they might open up those areas for drilling if the oil companies actually drill.
Which I thought was a great, great compromise, because that's the current law already.
Well,
the Democratic talking points are so far out of reality anyways, because the law already is, if you don't develop it within 10 years, it goes back to government. So conservatives will take that deal any days. Yes, sure. You know, if they don't develop it in what they have in 10 years, then it'll go back to government.
But we'll see about
the great deal. We'll take it.
I am by no means ecstatic about these compromises. My only point is that they're trying to find. They're trying to find cover is what they're trying to do. I think to some extent that they are. I think they haven't thought about actually engaging this debate in full and trying to turn the poll numbers back around. There's evidence with the gas tax holiday that you can do that. People do not like being pandered to. They're not interested in a proposal that's not going to save them money immediately. That's what they want. They don't have ideological opinions about this. So if you can make the case that this would not save you any immediately, you can change the poll numbers. So we'll see if they're trying to cave, if they're trying to put a proposal on that conservatives cannot accept so they can say they did something on the subject. I don't know. But it's really not evidence to me that they're gearing up to make the fully fact-based argument that coastal drilling won't save anybody any money.
Well, you know, we're definitely going to have this debate. The RNC's first major ad buy, which, of course, is not coordinated with the McCain campaign. But their first major ad buy for McCain was all about energy and portraying Obama as the Dr. No of energy. So,
and Obama did respond to that ad with that talking about how this went, Coastal Drilling wouldn't put any oil in the system for 7 years. It wasn't as strong as the gas tax holiday ads that he ran in May, but it was an attempt to respond. And I think that's one area where he should probably be leaning on Democrats in the Senate and in Congress to be echoing his messages and not trying to undercut them.
So it looks as though if the GOP has its way, we're going to find out if you're correct and whether or not Obama can turn that debate around.
We will see. But like anything, it requires a team effort. I mean, I don't think Obama did gas tax holiday by himself. He led, but other people came in to give him support, and that needs to happen now if he's going to turn these poll numbers around.
You wanted to talk about a major healthcare coalition that is developing.
Thank you. Even though we're short on time, I appreciate that. You know, my folks at Campaign for America's Future are part of this big coalition, Healthcare for America Now. It's a $40 million campaign to build that mandate for a system that would create a guaranteed choice. You'd have a guaranteed choice between private plans and a public insurance plan option to ensure that everybody had quality, affordable health care coverage. And the campaign started with a series of grassroots events around the country, and I was struck by not only did it get major blog coverage in places like, you know, Fire Dog Lake, Ezra Klein, who had the American Prospect, tends to cover health care issues, but you did see a number of local blogs, Calitix, Left in the West, Fact-esque in Pennsylvania, all talk about the grassroots actions happening in their states. You don't always see that level of coordination between, Washington groups and coalitions with bloggers at the grassroots level. This kind of effort did not happen a year in advance of the Bill Clinton healthcare proposal, which got chewed up by an avalanche of dollars from the insurance industry. This is an attempt to try to build up some infrastructure and put some resources behind it in advance of expectation of a battle like that, presuming there is a President Obama who's going to make healthcare be a priority in his first term.
Yeah, I was thoroughly impressed by the alphabet soup of groups behind this effort. Ezra Klein listed some of them. Okay. The American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees, Americans United for Change, Campaign for America's Future, Center for American Progress Action Fund, Center for Community of Change, MoveOn.org, National Education Association, National Women's Law Center, Planned Parenthood Federation of America, Service Employees International Union, United Food and Commercial Workers, and USA Action. That is quite a long list of progressive organizations and just a whole horde of federal American tax dollars and state and local tax dollars from municipal and county employees and federal employees going towards this $40 million to lobby the government. And then later in the article, Klein reveals that SEIU has their own separate, in addition to what they're contributing to this plan, their own separate $75 million set aside for the cause of health care reform. So that's a cool $115 million right there that progressives are going to be pouring into health care in the next year as the next president comes along. And I'll be honest with you, there is fear in this building about that.
Any plans to respond?
No, not yet. Not that I can report. There are efforts right here, but right now we're a little sidetracked by an advance notice of a proposed rulemaking on from the EPA on global warming. So
I'm sorry, sidetracked by what?
The advance notice for proposed rulemaking that is up, that is due out, that's probably going to come out tomorrow from the EPA on global warming.
It's a matter of lore. Well, I should say lore. It's factual, but part of the narrative of what went wrong with Clinton's health care plan, that Bill Kristol had a memo saying that it was, you could not take the Bob Dole approach of compromise here. You had to kill this thing cold. Don't negotiate. If Bill Clinton can get this done, Democrats will have a lock on the middle class for a generation. Is that same fear existing on the right now that this could actually happen and be a political problem for the conservative movement for a long time to come?
Not yet. It's not an issue on the radar screen. There's so many other things to worry about. Like I mentioned, the EPA's cap and trade fiat that they're planning is priority number one right now.
All right.
Okay.
Perhaps we'll end it there.
We will.
Next week, I'll be at Netroots Nation, so I think we'll do a blogging heads from there, shall we?
Sounds like a good live report coming up.
Excellent.
See you next week, Bill.
Take care.